Well, that seems a perfect intro for today's guest. He is one of the great documentarians of all time, Ken Burns, who returns to PBS next month with an epic TV event yet again. This one will be 10 episodes, 18 hours, focusing on the Vietnam War. He and his producing partner, Lynn Novick, have spent years and years putting this together, and I'm looking forward to it. I got to see a sampler of this last night and saw some of the scenes in there, and I want to start by sharing one Vietnam veteran remembering the hell of being caught in artillery fire.
Like almost like every hour, it'd be a barrage. People get blown to bits, literally blown to bits. You find a boot with a leg in it, right? And so is the leg white or black? So who was the white Marine that was here? Who was the black? So then you try to remember and you tag it and put that in the green bag. And that's what goes back, you know, as Marine Lance Corporal so-and-so and so. But sometimes you're not even sure because the body has literally been blown to bits and the only thing that's left is a foot or a piece of an arm.
That is the hell of war, as described by a Marine who was in the midst of it in Vietnam. And here's the man who put that documentary together, Ken Burns. Hi, Ken. How are you?
Well, thanks for having me.
I know how difficult it is to get Vietnam veterans to open up about their experiences. I've talked to many of them through the years, and they're very reticent to share those stories. How did you do it?
42 years after the fall of Saigon, we wanted to be able to go back and say, look, your war is not fully told. It didn't turn out very well for the Americans, and we tended to just sort of bury our heads in the sand. The soldiers we didn't treat very well coming home, and we certainly learned that lesson. But I think that we just reached out to these veterans and said, you know, we want to hear your story. We want to hear what happened. We want to make the Battle of Ap Bac and Binh Ja and other engagements, Yadrang Valley, as familiar to Americans as, say, Shiloh or Chickamauga or Appomattox might be in the Civil War. And that's been a problem. We have spent a good deal of time, almost half a century, sort of burying our head in the sand about it. And it's really time to go out and ask what happened. There's been enormous scholarship that's taken place in which we've been able to put a finer point on stuff that has remained questionable. The presidential tapes have been, much of it has been logged and transcribed. We have the veterans willing to speak. We had unique access to Vietnam itself, so we could go back and talk to soldiers there. We went into the South Vietnamese diaspora in the United States, all over the country, and spoke to those very hardworking and loyal Americans who were part of, the, you know, were our allies until their country disappeared. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very complex story. We talked to the people who were opposed to the war, Gold Star mothers, doctors, policy wonks in the Pentagon, you know, just trying to get a full picture of what happened.
Do the men who went and lived to tell the tale, do they look back on it as a waste?
You know, I think each individual story, each individual soldier is going to have a different take on that. Some of them, yes, but some of them found in their voice when they came back sort of something redeeming about speaking out. Others don't want to be told that that was the case and believe firmly in it. And so I think there is as many opinions about Vietnam as there are people, and too often these devolve instantaneously into an argument. And what we've tried to do is create a place in which all the various perspectives can coexist at the same time, and that we can possibly sort of crawl out of the hardened silos that we've been hiding in and have a conversation and see across the gap, see across the Thanksgiving dinner table, that it doesn't need to spark anger, that it could spark a courageous conversation that might move us away from that, help heal some of those ghosts. And of course, you know, the disunion that we suffer today, all of the hyper partisanship that we experience today, and nobody really wants that. Nobody in their right mind wants that, I believe, had its seeds in Vietnam. So if we were to sort of come and begin to understand it more than just the superficial conventional wisdom that people have, and I put wisdom in quotes, we might be able to move the dime not only on the ghosts of the past, but those demons that afflict us today. I mean, just think about it. What if I told you that I've been working for 10 years on a film about mass demonstrations all across the country against the current administration, that it's about a White House in disarray obsessed with leaks, that it's about a president accusing the media of lying, of making up stories, about huge document drops of classified, stolen classified material into the public sphere, which destabilizes everything, about an asymmetrical warfare that the mighty might of the U.S. military has a hard time sort of figuring out what to do, and accusations that a political campaign reached out during the time of war to a national election, reached out to a foreign power to help affect that election. You'd say, my God, Ken, you're not doing history, you're doing the present moment. But those are only six things from our Vietnam series out of maybe 600 things that resonate, that echo with today. And this is a film, remember, that I began in 2006.
Yep, the parallels are absolutely remarkable. And one other thing that's, well, there are many remarkable things about your series, but one of the things that I noticed in watching the preview of it last night was that you talked to former Viet Cong.
Yeah.
How do you find guys in Vietnam who used to not be North Vietnamese regular army, but the Viet Cong?
Yeah, so here's you know, it's, we are so lucky. This film couldn't have been made at any time, but right now, we got to know a Marine who was highly decorated Marine, and Vietnam kind of haunted him. And so in the 1980s, he went back, or one of the early folks to go back. And he began to open up relationships. He helped herd John McCain and John Kerry and Bob Kerry together to help push within the Senate for normalization. He's been at the Kennedy School at Harvard for many, many years, teaching a generation, two generations of Vietnamese leaders, always hoping to open up the country. It's still a repressive communist regime, but the people have a spectacular entrepreneurial spirit, and 75% were born after the fall of Saigon. And so he had many, many contacts. The government sort of trusted him, and we had access to the physical country, to its archives, which people have never before seen, as well as taking advantage of new scholarship. But most importantly, he introduced us to people, and we hired a Vietnamese producer, and we just say, look, we need to find a Viet Cong guerrilla who was at the Battle of Vap Bac or at the Battle of Binh Dra. Can you find him? And they have veterans groups the way we do, you know, and they reune the way we do, and they're all grandpas now the way we are. And you know, and American soldiers go back and they meet their doppelganger, their counterpart, and they've got, you know, it's love and hugs and all that sort of stuff, and you wish human beings would just skip to that part, but unfortunately that will never happen. Human nature is always will put us into defensive and then aggressive stances. But anyway, you know, we were able to meet, and after you overcome a little bit of culture and a lot of language, we're asking them the same things we're asking our Marines and GIs and pilots and helicopter pilots and nurses and doctors and POWs and Gold Star moms and draft resistors and all the folks, all the Americans, amazing Americans that make it up. And you begin to see, obviously, many, many differences, but you also see a lot of similarities. And it's kind of stunning and eerie that our Marines and GIs and our Army GIs are sounding like some of these Viet Cong guerrillas and NVA soldiers.
Are they heroes in Vietnam?
Oh, most definitely. And some of them wore all their fruit salad to the interview, you know. But some of them just came as civilians. And what I was really refreshed about, what I was worried about, is that everybody would just speak the party line, that they'd all be out of central casting. And they weren't. A couple of the guys admit to an awareness of or participation in a horrible massacre, you know, 10 times what My Lai was. And that's a massacre that to this day Hanoi does not acknowledge ever happened. And here they have two of their foot soldiers, now revered, beloved heroes of the revolution, you know, capital H, capital R, admitting to it. And so you get a kind of intimacy. And I think maybe the difference of language and of culture had them relax and say, okay, you know, this is going to an American audience. Let me tell you what I know.
You know, you mentioned the divisiveness in this country, Ken. I'm old enough to have actually been at the giant marches in Washington, D.C. I went with my mom one year and my dad one year. I think the first one was October of 69, which you have.
That's correct, October 15th. I went to the November 15th one in D.C.
Okay. I went to the one the following year with my other parent. I don't remember which one was there first. But I was also there at the Welcome Home concert at the Capitol Center in D.C.
Yeah.
in 1987. That was broadcast on HBO. I was covering it for the radio station I was working for there. And then later, I also helped raise funds when the Vietnam War Memorial in D.C. was defaced and scratched and the granite had to be repaired. So I've had connections to a lot of these things through the years, but I was always anti-Vietnam War. And you talk about the divisiveness. We're at war now. We have been at war with Iraq and Afghanistan for over a decade and a half, and yet no one talks about it, and virtually no one protests it. And I wonder if the difference between then and now is one word, draft.
That's exactly right. Or two words, national service. You know, let's say that there were a lot of lessons that could be learned from Vietnam, and clearly our policymakers learn them and then forget them pretty quickly. The military learned a lot of stuff, very practical, you know, innovative stuff. They didn't like collateral damage, so they designed precision bombing. They didn't like having their planes shot down, so they designed stealth technology. They wanted to be able to have the element of surprise, so they figured out how to fly at night. We do this better than anyone else on the planet. We also embed the reporters now, so they're not free roaming the country and getting stuff that they don't want to see. You know, the first Gulf War was conducted all by aging soldiers who've been in Vietnam and applied the lessons. But I think at the heart of it is that we now have a separate military class that suffers its losses apart and alone from the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
You could go into a high school auditorium in World War II and everybody would be involved. If you go into, even in Vietnam, everybody would know somebody and every male was eligible for the draft. And by removing that equation, you don't have, you know, the opposition to the Vietnam War started out as a moral opposition. This war is not right. It's not in our national self-interest. Why are we there? You know, that sort of stuff. But it did grow in extraordinary numbers when it changed from exemptions for college to no exemptions and the lottery. And then all of a sudden it became a self-interest movement. You know, I don't want my son killed. I don't want to die myself or whatever it is. And so the ranks of the anti-war movement really, really, you know, grew
mm-hmm.
and eventually represented a majority of American citizens who, through their election of their representatives, helped end the war. But nowadays, there is not that. And while we certainly are not going to blame the veterans again, our soldiers, and that is the permanent lesson, thank God,
yeah.
of the Vietnam War, we're also not keenly aware of this relatively tiny community among us that suffers these losses.
Right.
And that's something that I think we really have to examine. And I hope, you know, the film isn't, as you know, isn't advocating for anything, doesn't have a political point of view, doesn't have the thumb on the scale. We're umpires calling balls and strikes every minute of it. But if discussions came out of it, one of them I would hope would be about national service, so that all of us have skin in the game, because all of us hate this hyper-partisanship, and yet we are all independent free agents, which are devices in our own self-ratifying news source or fake news source or whatever it is. And wouldn't it be great to get back to where we were back in the 60s, as tumultuous as that was? You know, there was three networks and PBS, and, you know, you went to school the next day and everybody's seen the same thing, and now nobody's seen the same thing except in tiny little pockets, and that keeps us disconnected from each other. And when we're disconnected, we can begin to build a case that the other is different and therefore wrong or
mm-hmm.
bad. And that just isn't the case. As soon as you stare across the table with a Viet Cong guy or an NVA soldier and you see them talking about the same things that our Marines and GIs are talking about, you realize, oh my goodness, we're all the same.
Yeah. You mentioned the media coverage. How important do you think the nearly monolithic media coverage of the 60s and early 70s was in changing people's minds about this, considering it came into their living rooms every night?
Yeah, you know, I think we've exaggerated a little bit of that. I think the nightly news, which was often shorter than the half an hour it is, it was no live broadcast from the site, but we did have that Tet offensive, which for, you know, several days in most of Vietnam and for more than than 3 weeks in Hue was just this incredibly intimate familiarity with war. And I think as other stuff trickled in, as graphic photographs emerged, I think that went a long way. And as I was saying, I think the military said, you know, we'll give them a fancy name and say you're embedded, but that means we're surrounding you. So you're not going to be able to see the little girl, Kim Phuc, running down the road, 30% of her body burned by napalm, dropped by her own Air Force in mistake, thinking that she was a retreating enemy, or see the assassination of a North Vietnamese spy in the midst of the confusion of the Tet Offensive on the streets of Saigon by the head of the National Police, Luong. These are images that are etched into our mind. Media will find ways to get the story, and they've gone around a lot of these things. But nonetheless, it's not going to be as open ever again as it was then, and we're not going to ever again have the presidential tape. So, you know, my brand of filmmaking is top-down, meet bottom-up, and we've got two extraordinary heroes in our film from Missouri that I can't wait to introduce everybody to. But, you know, hearing, you know, the President Nixon going out one day and saying X, and then in the tape, he's saying, you know, Y and Z, and the same with Johnson, you know, I'm confident that we're winning, blah, 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 and then goes in and says, I don't see how we can win, you know. The same day or the next day or the next week, you begin to realize what an extraordinary gift for storytellers all those tapes are, combined with the photographs and the footage and the stuff, and now declassified material. And I don't mean just in the United States, but in Vietnam as well.
Yeah, it's the lies from five presidential administrations that still to this day make me angry. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin, of course, and the domino theory. And you mentioned guys from Missouri. I want to play a piece of audio. But before I do that, Tim, who's here in the studio with me, his brother served in Vietnam. And we were talking just before the show when he knew you were going to be on with me. They used to communicate with each other by sending little reel-to-reel tapes back and forth.
So are you about to play our Ozark Missourian?
I am. It's a guy by the name of Mike.
Michael Holmes, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was given here, you know, to tell you how you make this film over 10 years, is I was given a speech someplace, and somebody came up and told me the story about this guy, and that how he would send tapes home, and his family would send tapes back to him, and that's how they communicated. And I just said, oh, let me know, and I handed them the name of the co-producer, and we tracked it down, and we made Michael Holmes a really, I think, important story in our seventh episode of the film.
Yeah, it's wonderful, because you hear the messages from home going to him. They would gather the whole family around, 14 people.
The mom and dad ran a general store in this tiny, tiny little crossroads, you know, blink and it's gone, and everybody's there talking, and it's just, it's like, you know, a lot of what's happening in this country is a lot of people think that nobody cares about their story, that this is just a flyover country, and I'll be damned. And what I've tried to do in all my work, as you know, going back to even before the Civil War, is tell the story that all of us can listen to. I mean, certainly, you know, I have good ratings in Beacon Hill in Boston and Nob Hill in California, but I've got great ratings in Arkansas and Oklahoma and Alaska and West Virginia. And I'm very proud of that. My audience is everybody who calls themselves an American.
Well, you should be. And let's take a listen to Mike. Now, I talked about the family sending him, you know, hopeful and heartwarming messages on these tapes. And then he would send back messages which included some of the horrors of what he experienced over there. Roll it.
Yes, we burned down a whole lot of hooches today of these people who don't cooperate with us, you know. Yeah, I don't really understand it, because if they are, you know, not VC, and we do that to them, you know, treat them bad, then they're going to turn VC. The Army does everything backwards.
Now, that was an important message then, and by the way, an important message today, Ken.
Yeah. So we have what we call collateral damage. We have, you know, policy formed in abstract from on high, and it doesn't always translate well down into the field, and it's hard to instill in young men restraint, but it's also harder still to see how you can change the whole paradigm of war in Vietnam and say, you know, as our other our Marine, also from Missouri, says, you know, war is a real estate business, and you don't like getting wounded a second time in a place you've already taken.
Hmm. Wow. I like the fact that you don't use the John Kerry's and John McCain's of the world. You leave out the so-called heroic politicians. You have Max Cleland in there and maybe one other. But why did you make that decision?
Well, we made it, first off, and we did the same thing in World War II. Obviously, those famous people were all dead. But in this case, this is the Vietnam War is radioactive. And I went, one of the first meetings I had was to go to John McCain and John Kerry and said, look, I need your help. We're doing this stuff. You're going to be in it. Archivally, but we're not going to interview you because you're still got skin in the game and you're, you know, going to try to polish this. And we're not going to do Dr. Kissinger and we're not going to do Jane Fonda and all these other stuff. And there are a few people that you meet, some journalists that became famous but were cub wet behind their ears. Max Cleland, he's in twice and very innocuously. You don't know his story or get to see the extent of his suffering except in his face. And that's it. We really wanted these, for the most part, to be people that 99.99% of the United States had never seen, and to let them into your house like you would somebody, a family member at Thanksgiving, and realize, okay, well, they have a different point of view from me, but I'll listen to them, and they seem sincere enough. And when you see that, when you do wars, it's always conflicts, between people, you know, different tribes, different countries, between armies. But more often than not, the interesting thing are the conflicts within an individual. And what you watch are several dozen of our people go through extraordinary changes in the course of relating their story about the war and in walking back to their own experience in that war, and we've tried to represent that. I find that very interesting. They're Shakespearean characters. Yeah. I think Michael Holmes is certainly that. And our other Missourian is.
And I love the scenes of the POWs on the plane. The joy in their faces. One of them says that the flight attendant, stewardess, I guess, in those days, or may have been a nurse, I don't know, said to him, you know what? We knew you guys were coming, so on this plane you can have anything you want. What would you like? And he said, I want a Coke with crushed ice and some chewing gum. He had been locked away in a North Vietnamese prison for all those years dreaming of two things, yeah, a cold Coke and some chewing gum.
How about that? How about that? And then you realize, you know, the intimacy of that. That's actually an Army doctor named Hal Kushner, whose helicopter crashes. He's the only survivor in a night thing in bad weather into a mountain. And he's captured, and he spends most of his, most of several years, captive of the Viet Cong and NVA in South Vietnam in these makeshift jungle camps. And then he's finally moved towards the end of the war up to Hanoi and then goes into the Hanoi Hilton and the plantation or the other famous prisoner camps. But it's a pretty emotional moment when he comes back.
Ken Burns, you are one hell of a storyteller, and you've got one hell of a story to tell here. You and your producing partner, Lynn Novick, have put together something I am really looking forward to, and I know a lot of Americans are going to watch, the 10 episodes, 18 hours total, of The Vietnam War. It starts on PBS on Sunday, September 17th, and thank you so much for joining me here again today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.